I am Gideon, and I have pressed record.
Spock and Kirk continue to make a point of reserving time for the two of them to play chess without an audience, but that does not mean that they discontinue their practice of playing chess in Storik's presence. Spock, because he believes it to be a valuable educational experience for Storik. Kirk, because, in his own words, it would break the little guy's heart if we cut him off.
Fascinating,
Storik says, staring intently at the chessboard. May I ask a query? Spock ventures, and Storik nods. What is the source of your fascination with my chess message with... What is the sources of your fascination with my chess matches with Captain Kirk?
Your styles of play and your strategies are utterly different, yet each of you wins half of your games. It is my goal to combine your two styles of play into one cohesive strategy, which will allow me to defeat both of you.
Spock nods. It is an admirable goal, but Kirk shakes his head, smiling ruefully.
Don't tell anybody this, buddy, but in the interests of Spock's full disclosure parenting policy, you should know that we don't actually split the games. It's more like 60-40 in Spock's favor.
Was that difficult to say? Spock asks, attempting to clear his face or voice of smugness, evidently with little success, since Kirk responds by making a face and sticking his tongue out in the most juvenile manner.
Fascinating,
Storik says again, this time looking at Kirk.
Okay, I hear somebody laughing there.
Yeah, my roommate.
Okay. Although the extended notes portion of your personnel file describes you as arrogant and boastful, you are willing to sacrifice your ego in order to comply with Commander Spock's parenting values. Ouch!
Kirk exclaims, laughing and miming being struck in the chest by some sort of projectile.
Here's a clue, kid. Don't tell people about the mean things in their personnel file. It tends to make them sad.
Storik peers at Kirk closely.
You do not appear sad. In fact, you appear to be experiencing a high degree of mirth and amusement. That is because I...
Kirk points at himself dramatically.
I'm just more awesome than other people. Nothing gets me down.
Captain, if you were intending to convince me that you are not, in fact, arrogant and boastful, as your personnel file states, you've chosen... I think that must be Storik.
Okay. Captain, if you were intending to convince me that you are not, in fact, arrogant and boastful, as your personnel file states, you have chosen what appears to be a singularly ineffective strategy.
Kirk laughs loudly, and even Spock finds himself moved to quirk a corner of his mouth in amusement. Storik makes a cogent argument, he says, and Kirk holds up his hands in mock surrender.
I'm beset on all sides by Vulcan bitchiness! Ambush! Ambush!
Storik cocks his head to one side.
According to the military strategy lessons that you have incorporated into the human skills curriculum, an ambush must contain the element of surprise. Surely the fact that Commander Spock would second my statement could not have been a surprise to you. My observation was, after all, the product of inescapable logic, and the commander has never, to my knowledge, hesitated to engage in prudent deflation of your ego when he deems it necessary.
Kirk laughs again, throwing his head back and closing his eyes as his body shakes with mirth.
You've got me there, Storik. You're right. I should have known that once you started kicking my ass, Spock would join right in.
I am pleased to see that...
I think that's me, sorry. I am pleased that you see the logic of my position.
Storik says, looking extremely self-satisfied, before a sudden undignified yawn interrupts his smugness.
Looks like it's time for all good little Vulcans to hit the hay.
Kirk observes, and Storik's brows draw closer together in confusion.
Captain, I consider it extremely unlikely that dried cattle fodder is anywhere to be found on board the Enterprise, and if it were, I do not know what possible purpose could be served by striking it. If this is in some way related to our martial arts lessons, surely there is a more appropriate time.
Spock interrupts. Captain Kirk is using an illogical and fanciful human idiom to to hit the hay means to prepare for sleep.
I regret my ignorance,
Storik says stiffly, then departs for his bedroom before Spock can explain that that is not what he meant at all, that he meant to join the atmosphere of conviviality?
Conviviality.
Conviviality. That he meant to join the atmosphere of conviviality, not to terminate it.
You'll get there,
Kirk says quietly, picking up the chess pieces in his quick, deft fingers and packing them away. Spock allows the next several minutes to go unmarked as he watched those fingers dart in amongst the ranks of the captured pieces, treating a pawn with the same reverence and care as a queen. Spock's own hands rest uselessly on his thighs. Usually, he would assist the captain in packing away the pieces, but tonight he is content to observe. From over Kirk's shoulder, Spock sees Storik's head emerge from the doorway to his bedroom.
Captain Kirk?
Kirk twists in his chair to look at Storik and smile.
Yeah? Would you be amenable to recounting one of your educational anecdotes to me before I sleep? Sure, Storik,
Kirk says, rising from his chair and stretching gracefully.
You know me. There's nothing I like better than a ripping good educational anecdote.
Kirk follows Storik into his room. Spock knows from past observation that Kirk will sit in the chair beside the head of Storik's bed. Spock does not follow. Past observation also teaches him that his presence would not be welcome. Instead, he sits at the table, looking down at the clear, regimented squares of the chessboard while Jim's voice floats out through the doorway.
Once upon a time,
Spock hears,
there was a boy named Kal-El from a planet called Krypton.
Spock knows of no planet with the designation Krypton, but he keeps his silence, still listening.
When he was very little, his planet was destroyed, so his parents sent Kal-El off in a spaceship, which landed on Earth in the 20th century, in a place called Kansas, which is not very far from where I grew up.
Spock considers this coincidence. If these Kryptonians are a long-lived race, is it possible that this Kal-El was a childhood acquaintance of Jim's?
Kal-El was found by two humans, Martha and Jonathan Kent, and they raised him to be a good human being and named him Clark Kent. But because he was a Kryptonian, he had special powers. He was super strong, for example. So he used those powers to help people. And when he did that, he had an alternate identity called Superman.
As Spock hears Jim describe the incredibly improbable feats of this Superman, he begins to doubt the educational value of this narrative. But when he hears about how the alien boy raised among human becomes a hero, but when he hears about how the alien boy raised among humans becomes a hero and saves his new home planet, Earth, from destruction, he acknowledges that, educational or not, the story may have some merit after all.
Record, and we're live whenever.
His father's face appears on the vid screen, and Spock finds himself feeling uncharacteristic relief at the sight. His father's advice has nearly always been welcome and well considered, but recently, in regards to this subject, so complex and frequently impenetrable, Spock finds it invaluable. Father?
Spock, how is Storik?
He is well, Father.
How does his education proceed?
He is a promising student, Spock says. It strikes him that this may be an ideal juncture at which to address an issue that has been much on his mind. Carefully, he begins. Storik has embarked on martial arts training with several members of the crew with several members of the crew whom he has judged expert in their chosen techniques, including Lieutenant Sulu and Captain Kirk.
A worthy endeavor.
Indeed. Spock hesitates. He has chosen not to request my expertise in his training, despite my mastery of the Vulcan arts.
Do you view this development as a symptom of a larger rejection of Vulcan culture or values?
No, Father. There is no evidence to support that conclusion. Spock hesitates once more. I believe instead that it is a manifestation of a more personal rejection. Sarek waits patiently. Father, it has been apparent to me for some time that Storik prefers Captain Kirk's company to my own. Prefers Captain Kirk to myself. Spock does not attempt to conceal the degree to which this conclusion has a negative impact upon his satisfaction. There was a time when he would have made such an attempt, but his father is by now well aware of the degree to which the details of parenting are habitually a source of unusual reluctance.
Yeah. Perturbation. Okay.
There was a time when he would have made such an attempt, but his father is by now well aware of the degree to which the details of parenting are habitually a source of unusual perturbation.
Mm-hmm. Perturbation.
But his father is by now well aware of the degree to which the details of parenting are habitually a source of unusual perturbation in Spock's Vulcan calm. Spock is surprised to see a hint of humor in his father's eyes in response to his confession.
It is a curious paradox, is it not, Spock? Although all Vulcans are raised to disdain emotion and its outward signs, when confronted with an exceptional example of humankind, with all their strident and uncontrolled feeling, it is nearly always the case that we prefer their chaos to the order of our Vulcan brethren, rather than disdaining it as we are trained to do. Okay, I'm getting an echo of my own voice. That's not cool.
Oh, my microphone is unplugged. Just
okay.
A second. I need a new jack to plug it in. There we go.
Okay. So it was for me when I'm picking up my own voice again. So it was for me when I became aware that I preferred your mother to all of the Vulcan women of my acquaintance. So it was for you when you preferred your mother to me. And so it seems to be for Storik. Indeed, it seems that at this juncture, this particular preference must perhaps be elevated to the status of a family tradition.
Denied that as a child and as an adult, he did feel a marked preference for his mother's company, but in the self-absorption of childhood, it had never occurred to him that his father might notice that preference and might find it painful. In his own defense, he did not take much care of his father's feelings, in part because he labored under the misapprehension, partly attributed to Sarek himself, that his father had no feelings of which to be cautious. Nevertheless, Spock now finds himself prompted to offer some reassurance, despite his awareness that such reassurance may be unnecessary. I am always very grateful for your advice, Spock says, especially your willingness to share candidly your own experience of fatherhood. It has instilled in me a long overdue appreciation for your facility and the delicate task of parenting.
It is merely my duty,
Sarek replies, but he appears pleased.
How is Captain Kirk?
He too is well, Father.
Do you find him to be an acceptable parent for Storik?
I find him more than acceptable, Spock says firmly. I find him... Spock recalls his father's words. Exceptional, Father. An exceptional example of humankind.
Fascinating,
Sarek remarks, and Spock feels an inexplicable spark of nervousness at his father's reaction.
I very much wish to meet him,
Sarek continues,
in better circumstances than our last encounter.
Spock does not know why, but he immediately feels that this is a terrible, extremely illogical idea, likely to end in unforeseeable chaos and unavoidable humiliation, largely on his own part. Unfortunately, Spock says quickly, I do not think that will be possible for some time. although our recent encounter with the Jafini minefields has spared us the neutral zone patrol duty, for now, the Enterprise is a flagship of the fleet, and thus in high demand.
I understand,
says Sarek.
Are you permitted to disclose the nature of your next mission?
Spock nods. We have been called to Illo Ypsilon to take custody of the chief executive of their planetary government. He has been indicated on unknown charges. He has been indicted on unknown charges, and due to the difficulty presented in attempting to ensure a balanced and impartial trial on his home planet, he is being transferred to Andoria to be tried by a Federation court. It should present no danger, and I anticipate no particular challenge.
I am pleased by our discussion, Spock,
Sarek announces.
I look forward to seeing you and Captain Kirk soon.
Before Spock can again protest the unlikelihood of that occurrence, the vidscreen goes blank. For a few idle seconds, Spock contemplates his own feelings of anxiety at the prospect of a meeting between his father and his captain. But soon his thoughts return to their proper place, the upcoming mission on Illo Ypsilon. He takes a moment to be grateful that it looks to be a simple and straightforward mission. As the past 3 months have illustrated, attempting to provide for Storik's need is challenge enough.
Kirk nods at the figures on the view screen, receiving carefully calculated bows from them in return. Greetings, Minister Lesha, Minister Fawn, of Illo Ypsilon, Kirk says, getting an approving nod from Uhura for pronouncing everything right. My name is Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise. We hear you have a bit of a problem.
We do indeed, Captain,
says Minister Fawn, a young, dark-haired man in formal robes.
Are you familiar with the details of the situation?
Jim looks around the bridge, but everyone seems as clueless as he is, even Spock. No, Minister Fawn, I'm sorry to say that Starfleet only briefed us with a broad outline of your troubles. I understand we're here to retrieve your First Minister and deliver him to a Federation court on Andoria. Minister Lesha nods. She is quite a bit older than Fawn, and her hair is graying.
You are correct, Captain,
she says.
I can say this word, I promise. First Minister Chor has committed, is accused of,
Fawn interrupts,
has been charged with,
Lesha throws Fawn a quelling look,
a most heinous crime.
Fawn extends his hands toward the screen, appealing.
We cannot guarantee his safety or the impartiality of the trial here. There are many angry people,
Lesha observes blandly.
There are those who would see him lynched in the streets,
Fawn says, glaring at Lesha in such a way as to leave no doubt as to who he thinks those might be.
As there are those who would see him pardoned without trial. The First Minister is a powerful man. He holds the leashes to many callers,
Lesha says, looking directly at Fawn, her voice dripping with venom. What do you need from us, ministers? Jim asks. He's got a pretty good idea now why a hometown trial might not be such a good idea.
We need you to send a security team to retrieve First Minister. We need you to send a security team to retrieve First Minister Chor from the detention facility where he is currently being held,
Fawn tells them.
A large one, for his own protection. It is only 3 miles from the detention center to the shuttle port. But when mobs are roaming the city, anything may happen in 3 miles. Once he is aboard your shuttle,
Lesha continues,
we ask that you transport him to Andoria as quickly as possible, so that we, as a people, may soon put this atrocity behind us.
What is this crime that he's accused of? Jim asks warily. He'd been expecting some kind of corruption charge, embezzlement or something. But the words Lesha's using make him think there's something bigger here, something uglier. Lesha and Fawn glare at each other for a long moment without speaking, until Fawn says tersely,
I will not speak of it. I cannot. Lesha, please do not stray from those facts that can be proven. Why would I, when even those bare facts are sickening enough?
Sorry, the internet kind of glitched there. Could you say that bit again?
Why would I, when even those bare facts are sickening enough?
She replies, with a careful twist of her head, as Fawn turns away from the screen and begins to pace behind her.
The government of Illo Ypsilon,
Lesha begins,
has always prided itself on its ability to provide for every member of our society, giving shelter to the homeless, food to the hungry, care to the orphan, medicine to the sick. So it has been since we were just a colony, 6,000 farmers and an unprepossessing mud ball in a forgotten corner of the galaxy. Even now that our fields feed the people of countless worlds, and our people and our name are respected, we have not forgotten that commitment.
She takes a deep breath.
We maintain a network of orphanages,
she says, and Jim suddenly feels a radiating cold begin in the pit of his stomach, working its way through his veins.
The orphanages are the pride of our social safeguard system. Many children from the system have gone on to become great artists, statesmen, athletes, businessmen, and the education and medical care that those children receive is second to none. Of course, none of this can compensate for the loss of a parent, or soothe that kind of grief. But we do our best, and we are proud of our orphanages. First Minister Chor took a special pride in them, a special interest. This was not unusual. Just a second. What?
Sure.
Yes.
I was gonna invite you out. Jessica's gonna come pick me up. She was gonna get you over for dinner because she doesn't like chicken and bacon.
Okay.
And then we're gonna go to this like Walmart or whatever.
I'm good for now, but thanks for asking.
You have to say First Minister Chor again.
That's what I was just looking at where it was. First Minister. Oh my god, I swear I can say the word minister. It's not that hard, mouth. First Minister Chor took a special pride in them, a special interest. This was not unusual. They are worthy of such attention.
Jim notices, with a cold and clear kind of detachment, that Minister Lesha's hands are shaking where she holds them by her sides. He clenches his own hands on his chair, tightly enough to whiten his knuckles. But it doesn't help. His are shaking, too.
He visited them so often, especially the Plen Orphanage, which was a walk of mere minutes from his office.
Her voice breaks, raggedly, and she stands frozen in place, as if to take another step would be physically painful. When it becomes clear that she can't bring herself to continue, Fawn steps forward.
It was discovered a few weeks ago that for years, Minister Chor had been visiting the Plen Orphanage at night. The security tapes were altered, but clumsily. It is likely that he performed the alterations himself. His purpose there may have been entirely innocent.
Fawn says, in a pleading tone, as if he wants desperately to believe his own words, but Lesha wheels on him, her hands clawed, her face twisted.
You fool! You contemptible fool!
She cries.
You will not speak with the children. You are afraid to hear what they say, but I have spoken with them, with more than a dozen of them, too afraid at first to even look me in the eye as they told me the truth. I have gathered their testimony for the trial and listened to them answer those cold clinical questions. You monster of willing blindness.
She turns back to the screen, and Jim freezes with the irrational feeling that she's looking right at him, that somehow her eyes are seeking his across the thousands of miles.
He told them it was his right,
Lesha says, almost sobbing now.
He told them he was entitled because he was the first minister, and so they should not tell a soul how they should be honored at his attentions. And the dead of night, slithering into their beds like a snake, the little ones whose care was entrusted to him, to all of us.
She's sobbing in truth now, half in anger, half in shame. Jim thinks of the pride she told him about, the pride that the people of Elo Ypsilon felt for how well they cared for those in need, how well they provided for those who were vulnerable, and he aches with an echo of the shame they must feel. He can well believe that Minister Chor might have been lynched in the street. Jim tries not to think about the words that she'd used, the images they couldn't help but drag up from the dark corners of his brain that he hadn't wanted Spock to see, but he's frozen in his chair, powerless, thinking of men who feel entitled to things that aren't theirs to take, of slithering snakes in the night. "Thank you for sharing the truth with us," Jim hears himself say, gently. We will retrieve the First Minister within the next 5 hours and depart for Andoria as soon as we have him in custody. I am truly sorry for your pain." Uhura ends the transmission, then turns to look at Jim. "God," Jim thinks, "I must look fucking awful." Because everyone on the bridge, who's not still frozen with horror, is staring right at him now. Jim thinks for a moment about soldiering on, about ignoring everything and clinging onto his captain's chair as hard as he can, but he knows that's not fair. He knows what he has to do. "Mr. Spock," he calls, and his first officer steps up to his shoulder.
"Captain,"
he acknowledges. Jim takes a deep breath and dredges up a smile from somewhere. Uhura flinches when she sees it. "With full appreciation of the irony of the situation, I officially relinquish command of the Enterprise to you, Commander Spock. I am emotionally compromised by the mission at hand." Everyone but Spock looks stunned. Spock, instead, looks like he's about to protest. Jim stares him down, and whatever Spock sees in his eyes, or whatever Spock saw in his head, must be enough.
"I look forward to your return at the successful termination of this mission, Jim,"
Spock says quietly. And Jim nods his thanks and walks off the bridge. The looks he gets as he heads for engineering tell him that, just his luck, that transmission reached most of the ship. Well, Jim thinks, trying to salvage something good out of this shitstorm, it'll save a lot of individual awkward explanations. He finds the person he's looking for hunched over paperwork in the engineering office. "Gayla, can you take Storik for a while?" Gayla looks up at him, wide-eyed, and nods.
"Of course, Captain."
There's no judgment in her tone, but Jim still feels defensive. It's not that I don't want to see him, or that I don't..."
"Captain. Jim."
Gayla meets his gaze and holds it.
"I understand,"
she says.
"I understand."
Jim remembers suddenly the day in basic xenology when the professor had delivered a lecture on the Orion slave trade, and how Gayla, sitting next to him, had taken beautiful, exhaustive notes that day, never looking at anything but the professor's face or her pad. All the other cadets had turned to look at her, but she just took her notes, her stylus pressing down so hard into the pad that its screen was washed with flares of color. When class was dismissed, Jim had tried to talk to her, but she had just said quietly that she didn't really want to be around people and gone off on her own. She understands. "Thank you," Jim says.
"It's no hardship,"
Jim tells him, smiling.
Gayla tells him.
I'm sorry. Gayla tells him, smiling.
"I love Storik. We all do."
She pauses.
"None of us would ever let anything happen to him,"
she adds with emphasis. "I know. Thanks.
"What about Commander Spock?"
Gayla asks. Once again, Jim gets the uncomfortable feeling that she sees more than he wants her to. "Acting Captain Spock will complete this mission admirably," Jim says. But he knows that's not what she means. As soon as Spock has a free split second, he's going to be in Jim's quarters demanding an explanation. And Jim knows it's past time he should have given one.
he'll do the right thing.
Gala says with absolute confidence.
Human custom dictates that when someone is having a difficult experience, you should both give them their space and embrace them. I don't think I can do both. Which do you want?
Jim holds out his arms wordlessly, and Gala pulls him close into a warm hug.
The sisters shine their starlight on you,
she whispers in his ear.
On the dark places in your soul, that you may look without fear. Such is my prayer. I seal it with touch.
She pulls back slowly and plants a soft kiss on his forehead. I didn't know you were religious, Jim says, which is stupid, but he's not at his best right now.
There's more to Orion than the slave trade,
she tells him calmly.
Go take a nap or masturbate or read a book. Spock will find you when he can.
Thanks, Gala. Will do. Gala's suggestions are all basically good, but in the end, Jim just lies flat on his bed and stares up at the ceiling, trying to think of what to say, until the door chimes and it's game time. Press record.
When Spock enters the captain's quarters, he finds Jim seated on the bed, looking up at him with a blankness and control that even a Vulcan would admire. We have retrieved First Minister Chor, and Mr. Chekov is plotting our course to Andoria, even as we speak.
You sound like a couple minutes ago you moved the microphone closer, so your voice is louder, but I'm also hearing like a lot of, like, fabric rustling noises or shifting noises with a microphone.
Okay.
I don't know. Anyway. Did you go down?
I'll read that again.
Okay.
When Spock enters the captain's quarters, he finds Jim seated on the bed, looking up at him with a blankness and control that even a Vulcan would admire. We have retrieved First Minister Chor, and Mr. Chekov is plotting our course to Andoria, even as we speak.
Did you go down with a security team? Jim asks. Oh.
Jim asks. Spock nods. It was extremely chaotic, and I believe it unlikely that the First Minister that... And I believe it unlikely that the First Minister would have survived were we not present. But he was escorted to the shuttle unscathed. The security team sustained relatively few injuries, 3 broken bones and assorted lacerations and abrasions.
They're in sick bay now?
Indeed, Spock replies. He hesitates, unsure whether to go on, but as his predicament is of an emotional nature, he cannot think whom else he would ask. There was a woman in the crowd, he begins. She followed us to the shuttle. She was weeping.
That sucks,
Jim volunteers. She asked me if I had any children. She asked me how I would feel if my children had been abused in such a manner.
What kind of a question is that?
Jim mutters without looking at Spock. His tone is dismissive, incredulous, but there is a strange energy to his stillness that leads Spock to believe that there is more under the surface than he knows. Her question, Spock says, if such a thing were to happen to Storik, I... He breathes and tries again. I would be emotionally compromised, he says finally, as I am sure would you. But there has been no such occurrence, says Spock. The moment that the words leave his mouth, he is struck with a freezing uncertainty, and he turns to look at Jim. Whatever is in his eyes makes Jim jump up from the bed and reach out to take Spock's arm in his hands, shaking his head and saying,
No, no, no!
Over and over again.
It's not Storik,
Jim tells him.
Nothing's happened to Storik. Storik's fine.
Spock takes another slow breath and brushes non-existent dust from the fabric of his tunic. To say that he calms down would imply that he had succumbed to a period where he was not calm, which would not be Vulcan. Nevertheless, it is true. Spock is attempting to determine how best to ask the intrusive and personal questions that he must, nonetheless, ask, when he hears Jim say something so softly that even Spock's Vulcan ears cannot be certain of it. When Spock looks up questioningly, Jim meets his gaze unflinchingly, and says, more strongly this time,
"It's me, Spock."
Although he should not be surprised, there have been hints all along, which Spock has ignored out of deference to Jim's privacy and Spock's own ineptitude with human emotion. He is still struck dumb by Jim's simple pronouncement. He continues to say nothing, and moves robotically when Jim guides him to sit on the edge of the bed, and he joins him there. Spock, with his higher body temperature, feels no heat radiating across the careful 6 inches that Jim has left between their bodies. But there is something there, some charge, that shadows his awareness as Jim looks into the distance and begins to speak.
"You remember what Minister Lesha said? Entitled? My stepdad thought he was entitled. He told me that. How, when he married Mom, he thought she was going to be around, but she wasn't. So it was my job to make it up to him. How it was my fault that she was gone. So I had to pay him back. I didn't believe him. Not for a minute. But it still pissed me off."
Jim does not know how to meet
Jim's anger. Spock.
Oh, sorry. Spock does not know how to meet Jim's anger. He has anger of his own to offer. Anger at this man whose name he does not know, but whom he would strike on sight, were they ever to meet. Anger at the mother that Jim cannot bring himself to blame. Spock has no such scruples. But Spock somehow senses that Jim does not want his anger, might even mistake its target and take it for a rejection. So instead, Spock musters his few and poor emotional resources and excavates the sorrow and loss buried under Jim's rage. To those, he knows the proper response. To those, he knows the proper response. "I grieve with thee," he tells Jim, and is pleased when Jim seems to take comfort in Spock's stilted and formal offering.
"I've never told anybody else,"
Jim says quietly, amending.
"Well, once 2 years ago, when I was really, really drunk, I told Bones."
"Was Dr. McCoy's reaction upsetting?" Spock asks, before he has time to become angry again. Before he has time to become angry again on Jim's behalf, the captain shakes his head.
"No, not upsetting. At least, not the way you mean. It's not like he was mean to me or called me names or made me feel like... I don't know. I mean, it was fine, what I remember of it. You can't tell anyone."
Spock nods. He thinks illogically that there is not much that Jim could ask for Spock. That Spock would not give at this moment.
"Bones. Fuck."
Jim runs his hand through his hair.
"He cried. I don't even... Do you know how long it's been since I cried over it? Years. I'd stopped crying about it before it even stopped happening. I mean, sooner or later, you just run out. But, yeah, he cried, which freaked me out. And the next 2 weeks were rough, because I barely remembered what happened, and Bones couldn't decide whether to treat me with kid gloves or whether to try too hard to pretend that things were normal."
Spock makes a note to avoid those two modes of behavior, if possible.
"We got it back, though,"
Jim continues.
"Got back to being best friends. So, anyway..."
Jim trails off.
"Bones is the only person I ever told,"
he says softly.
"Until now. Until you."
"Why?" Spock asks, which is distressingly imprecise, but which Jim seems to understand. He blows out a sharp breath and rubs his hands over his thighs before he speaks.
"The timing isn't... I wouldn't have picked this now, but you deserve to know. I mean, you're letting me raise your kid. You should know. I probably should have told you that first day, but yeah."
There's a thread of shame and a thread of fear running through Jim's voice, which Spock does not understand. "Do you believe that I will alter my opinion of your fitness as Storik's parent in the light of this revelation?" Jim shrugs, which Spock knows by now to read as an affirmative.
"You could,"
Jim says.
You wouldn't be crazy. I mean, you knew I was fucked up. I was upfront about that. But not this fucked up. Not fucked up in this way, you know?
Jim looks away.
Besides, you'll probably want to be watching, I guess. I swear to you.
He says, looking back at Spock urgently.
I swear on this ship, on anything that you want, that I love that little guy more than my own life, okay? And I would never hurt him. God, I would cut off my own hands if I ever even thought about.
He trails off, and the shadow over his eyes looks like bruises.
But I understand it looks bad.
He says, his voice carefully controlled.
I know the numbers say that the kids of abusers, whatever the hell that word actually means, are more likely to turn out the same, so, yeah, I wouldn't blame you.
Jim is looking determinedly into the middle distance, and that is unacceptable, because Spock knows that eye contact is a mark of sincerity in human communication, and it is imperative that Jim believe in the sincerity of Spock's reply. Any other outcome would be intolerable. It is for this reason that Spock reaches out his hand to place it softly on the lower part of Jim's face. The lower, so as not to give the impression of an attempted... a mind meld, and turns Jim's face to him until they are eye to eye. Jim, Spock says simply, no. It is clear by the movement of the muscles surrounding Jim's eyes that he still does not understand, so Spock reaches for the words he thinks his mother might have used. I know you, Jim. We have been honest with each other. If you feel that you cannot trust yourself, I offer you my certainty. It is absolute. Jim appears to consider this carefully, searching Spock's eyes for something, until, finding it, he says quietly,
I'll take that.
Silence falls between the two of them once again, pregnant with meaning, but not uncomfortable.
Gayla's taking care of Storik,
Jim says, and Spock nods.
I should tell him.
Spock turns to look at Jim, surprised, and finds a look of determination on the captain's face.
I mean, if that's okay with you, he'll want to know why I handed over the ship, for one thing. And...
Jim's hands turn to lie open and empty on his lap.
Nobody's entitled,
he says in a voice that is low, but hard.
I'm sure he knows that, but... just to make sure.
Vulcan society has always valued courage. In the era before Serac, the time of warriors, it had been the most prized quality a Vulcan could possess, meriting the attention of the poets and the memory of history. It is still considered a desirable trait, the strength of will necessary to do what is logical, even when it may cause harm to oneself. But it has ceased to be valued in and of itself. Now it is merely one of a suite of supporting virtues that aid one in the pursuit of the ultimate goal, logic. Spock thinks, at this moment, watching Jim hold his head as if he has not, just 5 minutes ago, been crippled with shame, watching Jim clench his fists as if fear is an enemy that can be struck down with sheer force of will, like all the others he has defeated. Spock thinks that perhaps Vulcans have lost something in that exchange. I have no objection to your plan, Spock says, which is insufficient, but which it is not in his nature to exceed. If you would find it beneficial, I would be willing to accompany you, he starts to offer, but Jim shakes his head and interrupts.
You know what I really want?
It appears that I do not, Spock admits, and Jim cracks an extremely weary smile and points a finger.
That. I need you to make fun of me, and raise your eyebrow at me.
In regards to the matter of the eyebrow, Spock is only too willing to oblige, though he cannot say he fully understands.
Like that,
Jim tells him, nodding.
And tell me how illogical I am, and take all of my idioms literally.
Why? Spock asks, puzzled, and Jim's answering look is sharp.
Because you can. That's how we do it, and that's still how we're gonna do it.
Spock could tell Jim that he has never believed Jim to be fragile. Tell him that Spock knows that for Jim, as for Spock himself, to be treated as if he were a liability would be the greatest injury of all. But it appears that that is not what Jim needs from him. So instead, he says, I am uncertain whether the statement could have possibly been more vague, even if you had exerted significant effort in the attempt to make it so. And Jim says,
Oh, I bet it could have been.
And Spock raises his eyebrow once again, recalling the beneficial effects of the previous occurrence, and says, I am willing to categorically state that I believe the outcome to be I am willing to categorically state that I believe that outcome to be impossible. And Jim winks at Spock and says,
I'm Captain James T. Kirk. I eat impossible outcomes for breakfast.
As Spock reminds Jim that he is not currently captain of anything, going on a brief tangent to mention his own current possession of Jim's chair on the bridge, which provokes the desired level of annoyance, as measured by the narrowing of Jim's eyes and the twitching of his jaw, before moving forward to an extremely pedantic discourse on the subject of consuming intangible concepts at any time of day, let alone the early morning, he feels again that charge between them. In the back of his mind, in a sector not required for maintaining his banter with the captain, he analyzes his own recollections, and concludes that he can trace the existence of this barely present connection to the occasion of his mind meld with Jim. In the intervening months, Spock observes from the contents of his memory, it has grown stronger. Tonight, it is stronger yet. After what seems to Spock an excessively frivolous amount of time spent in... Voluble?
Mm-hmm.
After what seems to Spock an excessively frivolous amount of time spent in voluble discourse, Jim retires to his own rooms, with a promise to supervise Storick for the duration of the mission. Spock waits until Jim has left, then walks swiftly to his computer terminal. He begins a search for Winona Kirk, knowing that it will lead him to marriage certificates, which will lead him to a name, which will lead him to an address. The computer finishes its search, and the list of results appears. Or at least, the list of results should appear. In reality, a blank screen pops up on Spock's terminal. On it are six words. Don't even think about it, Spock. Spock is amused and slightly impressed, but not discouraged. On Andoria, there will be many computer terminals with access to Federation databases, hopefully free of the interference of one James T. Kirk, although Spock, now that he gives the matter consideration, would not put it past Jim to have hacked the entire Federation computer system by now, removing remote access to his mother's files. It is of no consequence. Spock has always cultivated the virtue of patience. In time, be it weeks or months, Jim's vigilance will lapse. Spock will be prepared. Satisfied in that prospect, Spock performs his ablutions, then slinks into a necessary sleep.